Pre-Socratics, Part 4, the fifth talk in a series titled The Bible and the History of Ideas, was presented by Jack Crabtree on October 31, 2012, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The handout mentioned in this talk is handout number 2 in this series.
What I'm going to do is finish up on the pre-Socratics. We just have some loose ends to, and I won't talk about any more pre-Socratic philosophers, but I want to just kind of analyze the phenomenon and compare what they're doing and what they're saying with the biblical worldview before we go on to the Sophists and Socrates. If we have time, we'll begin to talk about the Sophists tonight, but we'll just see how it goes. So we looked at all these different pre-Socratic philosophers, the Milesian school, his Thales, Anaximander, and Anaxenemes. We looked at the Pythagoreans, Heraclitus, the Eleatic school, Parmenides and Zeno in particular. Then we looked at Empedocles and Anaxagoras and the Atomists. So we've looked at some of the particulars of their philosophy, but there are several issues that they are all exploring, that they take their own distinctive perspective on, or they choose a perspective on. So on your chart that I gave you last week, we have those last three columns to look at. Ultimate reality, is it changeable or is it permanent? For the Milesian school, ultimate reality is changeable. So that which is fundamental, that which is essential, whether it's water or air or the indeterminate, whatever the fundamental, essential, underlying, foundational reality is, it's in flux, it changes. And everything comes to be because that changes form. Water changes form, air changes form, the indeterminate divides out, separates out. With the Pythagoreans, it's harder to answer that question, how they would answer, is it changeable or permanent? It would seem to be that it's changeable because numbers come into existence. The thing that they call numbers come into existence because the unlimited breathes in the limited. And keep that in mind, because when we get to Plato's theory of forms, there's a great analogy between what the Pythagoreans are saying there and Plato's theory of forms, is that what they call the unlimited is just this basic potentiality that something might exist. But the potentiality that something might exist, nothing exists there, only in potential, but nothing exists there until something limits what that potentiality is and defines it as something in particular. And that's what Plato will call a form, and that's what the Pythagoreans call the limited. So it makes it something in particular rather than anything in general. So it would seem like you have the necessity of this breathing of the unlimited, the limited into the unlimited, that has to be before anything can come into existence at all. So is that permanence or is that changeability? I'm not exactly sure. When you get to Heraclitus, the ultimate is changeable because change is actually essential to existence itself. Remember, he's the one who said you can't step into the same river twice. That the very existence of the river is a fluctuating, dynamic, changing reality. It's not a static reality. It's not a fixed thing. It's a moving, changing thing in flux. And all existence, for Heraclitus, all existence is that kind of thing in flux. The Eleatic school then goes the other direction. Is ultimate reality changeable? No, it's unchangeable. It's absolutely unchangeable. It never changes. There is no change. In fact, they go so far as to say change is an illusion. there really is no such thing as change. Empedocles, ultimate reality is unchangeable, taking his cues from the Eleatic school, Parmenides. It's unchangeable, but change is real. Unlike Parmenides, who says change is an illusion, he's prepared to say change is real. But how does change come about? By just different ways in which that which is unchangeable combines. So a permanent unchangeable reality that underlies all things brings about real change as that which is ultimately unchangeable recombines into different forms and different combinations. Same with Anaxagoras. He's basically making the same claim. It's just that we have unlimited number of elements with Anaxagoras. Empedocles had four elements. Atomism, ultimate reality is a little onesie, a little atom, a little unit, undividable, uncuttable, undestroyable, indestructible unit of being, and that's unchangeable. But again, they combine in different combinations to bring about the different things that exist, so change is real for them as well. So how does that compare with the biblical worldview? What would the Bible say with respect to the question, is ultimate reality changeable or is it permanent and enduring and static in that way? Well, before I get to the biblical worldview, what about the Christian worldview? Because when you get into the Middle Ages, much of Christian theology has been influenced by Greek philosophy going all the way back to the pre-Socratics. So a primary component of theology in the Middle Ages says that God is a simple, undividable, utterly unchanging being. Where does that come from? I mean, where would you go to the Bible to find out that God is a simple, undividable, unitary, not having any parts, unchangeable being? That's coming from here. That's not coming from the Bible. You see that? So instead, what about the biblical worldview? Well, it seems to me that the ultimate reality, you have to, in the biblical worldview, first of all, you need to make a distinction between the transcendent reality and ask the question, is that ultimate reality changing or permanent? And then you have to talk about created reality. And they're not necessarily going to give the same answer to both of those. Well, what about the transcendent ultimate reality? I think we'd have to say it's changing. And why would I say that it's changing? Because God, contrary to the claim Christians make in the Middle Ages, God is not simple. God is a person. As a person, he's described as having passions, being pleased, being wrathful, having purposes. His purposes change over time, or at least his activity to bring about his purposes certainly change over time. There was a time, presumably, when God had no creation to relate to, and then he created reality, and now he's in relationship to created reality. That changes something about who God is. So it seems to me, it's certainly arguable, that the biblical worldview would answer the question, ultimate transcendent reality is a moving, changing, fluctuating reality. It's not a static, simple, fixed, permanent reality. Now, God is obviously permanent in the sense that he's not destructible. He's not going anywhere. He's here to stay, and he's permanent in that sense. But that's a different kind of permanence than you find in the pre-Socratics, where it's just, it is what it is, and nothing can change it, and it is unchanging. No, God is not unchanging. Nothing is helpful about thinking of God as unchanging when we look at the Bible. Now, oftentimes the verse is quoted, Jesus Christ, the same yesterday, today, and forever. Well, notice, first of all, it's Jesus Christ who's the same yesterday, day, and forever, not God. And that distinction gets lost when we quote that verse. But in any case, what's the point that he's making there? In that context, the issue is, who is this Jesus we believe in? Is he a moving target? Can you in one generation believe in one Jesus and then three generations later believe in a different Jesus, and you're all Christians, you're all followers of Jesus, you're still on the same page? No. There's one and only one Jesus, who's the Son of God sent by God into the world, and he doesn't, his teaching doesn't change, his role doesn't change, his function doesn't change. There's one and only one Jesus who counts. And there's no, he's not subject to different interpretations in different generations. That's what that verse is saying. It's not saying anything about the question that the pre-Socratics are exploring. What about the nature of the being of God and the nature of the being of created reality? And I would argue that created reality also, ultimate created reality, is also changing in its nature. Now, why? Because I'm becoming increasingly convinced that we cannot understand the biblical worldview unless we understand that the reality that we're a part of is a story, a narrative, and a narrative by its very nature is changing. It's not simple, undivided, and permanent like an atom is. It's by its very nature in flux. And in that regard, Heraclitus is closer to the truth than any of the other pre-Socratic philosophers, I think, because this reality that we're a part of is like a river. It's identifiable as a thing on the one hand, but the thing that it is a moving and dynamic thing that is constantly changing and ever different in a lot of ways. Bob, did you have a...
You may have just spoken to what I was going to say, but if God is unchanging in the sense of he's permanent, but changing in the sense that he's constantly creating a narrative, the source of the change, whatever, however we can apply that to God, must be himself.
Right, that's right.
Because I think of change as something acts on something else, something causes an effect in something else. And so change is produced by something external to me, but maybe I'm refuting myself, because maybe I change myself too.
I think so. I mean, I think that's what repentance is, mm-hmm. is self-changing, self-turning.
So can you speak just a little bit more on the idea that God is permanent? And I know you've heard you say the most real being. Mm-hmm. But also is in a dynamic flow.
Well, the simplest way to describe it is that, I mean, compare the permanence of an atom to the atomos. It's just this little, indestructible, undividable little ball of being. God is a person. Well, a person is not a big ball of being. A person has all these interdynamic, you know, I have a will, a mind, emotion, purpose, intent. All that goes together to make me the person that I am. Well, that's a very complex interaction between a lot of different factors, a lot of different elements. That's not what an atom is. So that's what I mean, is the person may be permanent. He may be indestructible, immortal, not going anywhere, and will dwell and be forever and ever and always has been. But it's still a person that always has been and always will be. That's what I'm getting at. Okay? Let me just parenthetically then, what we're just talking about here in a way illustrates to me one of the values of exploring the history of ideas, of understanding the history of philosophy and so on. I doubt that most of us reading the Bible would have ever stopped to ask ourselves the question, is God permanent and unchanging and simple and undivided, or is God changing and dynamic? What sort of being is he? The Bible doesn't really invite that kind of question, but the fact that all of these people are exploring this question brings me up to asking the question, well, what, as a Bible student, what do I think about that? I mean, what is the answer to that question? And on the one hand, it may seem, well, who cares? I mean, how is that relevant? On the other hand, I think it's highly relevant in the end, because I can't answer the question without getting clearer on who God is. And that's the whole point. Knowing God is really kind of the whole point of our existence. So if I can get clearer on who God is and what the implications of who God is are, then I know God better. And sometimes asking a question out of left field that I never would have occurred to ask forces me to get a clearer conception in order to answer the question. And I think that's what this does for me here. It forces me to get, the idea of, what is a person? Is a person changing or is a person unchanging? And recognizing that there's all that evidence in the Bible that should have told me the answer to that question, but I wasn't asking the question. But when the Bible talks about God loves you, God hates somebody, God is angry with somebody, wrathful towards somebody, God is pleased with somebody, that kind of thing, that's not an atom reacting. That's a person reacting. And so I have to get clearer about the nature of personhood is such that it is complex and it is dynamic and it is interactive. Well, that's who God is. He's dynamic and interactive and complex.
When you say that God is a person, you're talking about the transcendent God.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So his personhood must be different, what you're thinking, because God is a spirit.
Right.
And so what you're classifying as a person is not a human flesh type person
no
Jesus
body.
Was. Right.
Right, yeah.
So I just want, maybe you can comment on that.
No,
so
that's a great question. I should learn from this that for a lot of people, person means a body or implies a body. It doesn't to me, and it's probably because I've been too immersed in philosophy too long that it doesn't even occur to me to attach it to a body. No, what I mean by person is has rationality, is subject to thinking in terms of and being in terms of moral categories. So it's unlike animals that are not moral beings, a person is a moral being. What philosophers call intentionality, a person is, animals are not intentional, and don't think of the word the way we use it out on the street. Intentional doesn't mean purposive, it means able to distinguish myself from that which is not myself, because I'm able to refer thoughts in my head to things outside of me. That's what philosophers call intentionality. And it's a remarkable thing about human beings that we have intentionality. Animals don't, presumably. I mean, last time I checked. Animals don't wonder about the meaning of their existence. They haven't got far enough to realize they have existence. So they're not worried about the meaning of their existence, whereas we do. We recognize that I am a self.
Okay, and then, so you're saying then that Jesus is unchanging. And is that what you're saying? I mean,
His message is
the same.
Well, what I was talking about is that verse in Hebrews, I think it is. Where is it? Yeah.
He's the same today.
He's the same yesterday, today, and forever.
Right.
That's what I was talking about when I said, yeah, his message does not change. His role does not change. The interpretation of who Jesus is should be the same every generation throughout history. He doesn't change in that sense. But that's totally unrelated to how we're taking the pre-Socratics question, because their question is, what about the being of Jesus? What kind of being is it? Well, human being is changing, not unchanging. I'm not a little uncuttable atom. I am A-T-O-M. I am a I am a dynamic person, changing person.
Okay. And then going up to the transcendent God, you're saying that he is in flux or changing?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's a much more beneficial way to think of the God of the Bible than as an unchanging, static monad.
So does that mean then that the story is changing, that he's changing the story as he goes along?
Well, that the story is changing, but what the Bible tells us is that God has already conceived the entire story before he even began to actualize it. So it doesn't change in the sense that, you know, God gets to the next century and go, I don't like the way this is going.
Right, that's what
I'm going to change this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not changing in that sense.
But when you say God's changing, his moral character as such isn't changing. I mean, he's not flip-flopping back and forth. His purposes and his moral character and his whatever you describe it would be consistent with who he is.
Right. His rationality is consistent. His morality is consistent. He's good and he's not evil.
Yeah.
And that will always be true and always has been true. Yeah. No, he's not changing in that sense. Yeah. But what I'm doing by emphasizing the changing nature of here, is trying to contrast it with the medieval notion of God as this incredible monad in the sky. We'll get to Aristotle. Aristotle's concept of the ultimate being is the unmoved mover. He's unmoved, that is, nothing changes him. He can't change from outside or from inside. Because the argument is simple. Well, he's perfect. You only change when you have to become more perfect. You can't get more perfect than God, so you can't change. I mean, the logic of that is impeccable, but it's just wrong. Yes, God is perfect. He's good and only good. But can't a river be good and still be changing? I mean, not good, but good fishing anyway. Can't a river be a good example of a thing called a river? But by its very nature, its essential nature, is it's in flux. Well, that's true of persons, too. Persons can be good, permanently good, only good, and I mean, if in theory, only good. But we're persons, and as persons, our relationship to our environment is constantly in flux. We're changing. We're relating to this person now, and this person now, and this thing now, and this circumstance now, and another circumstance later. And I change as I change in my relationship to my environment. And that's just part of being a person. And God is a person, the transcendent God is a person, and Jesus is a person.
Let me just ask a quick question, showing my ignorance of Aristotle. Showing my ignorance of Aristotle, that isn't what he's trying to get at when he refers to God as the unmoved mover, that there is that perfection, but that doesn't the moving part then refer to changing, responding?
No. See, he doesn't. God never interacts. The unmoved mover. Excuse me. The unmoved mover never interacts with the rest of reality. The rest of reality responds to him. And Aristotle is very clear about that. He only moves by attraction, not as an efficient cause. You know, he doesn't reach out and move things around. He just sits there being perfect. And his perfect is so attractive that things move by being attracted to that.
Tobias had a question about the difference between humans and animals and what makes us intelligent. Is it something physical or something supernatural? So, like, is it the makeup of our brains or something else? I think that's his question.
Well, that's a great question. I think ultimately it's something more than physical. I'd make a distinction between personhood and rationality. Rationality is not something that's absolutely unique to human beings. I mean, for goodness sakes, we've made machines that are rational now. that computer on your desk is an incredible instrument of rationality. And we have mapped rationality onto the circuit boards of that little machine. I mean, so to call it not rational that'd be an incredible claim to call it not rational. But its rationality is derived from our rationality. We had to invent the full thing. We had to design the circuit. We had to program the machine. So even though it's rational, it's not a person. We are more than our rationality is the highest form of rationality that we know. I mean, I've never played chess with an angel, so I don't know about angels, but it's the highest form of rationality that we know. But even there, we can invent machines that remember better than we do and access some information better than we do because they don't get bored. I mean, there's lots of ways in which the rationality of machines enhances our rationality because it, in some respects, is better than ours. Aristotle is going to go on to say that that's what's distinctive about human beings, is that they are rational and other beings are not. I don't think that's true. So apes are rational. They do problem solving. They do all kinds of things that are rational by their very nature. Now, their rationality may very well be organic and therefore physical, just like a computer's rationality is physical and material. They're just doing what their programming says to do. But God, being the designer of those organic computers that he is, has mapped rationality onto their programming, into them instinctually. Now, that's the most popular view at the university today, is that our rationality is just like that. It's evolution just mapped rationality into the wires in our brain, and that there really is no such thing as mind. There is only a brain. But that gets pretty silly in the end. I mean, I had a class on philosophy of mind in graduate school, and we read two or three textbooks where their perspective was, there's a famous couple of philosophers who, what's their name? The Churchlands, I think it is. And they say there's no such thing as beliefs or intentions or feelings or fears. I mean, take anything that you talk about yourself, they don't exist. That's what they call folk psychology. It's like to believe that you have a belief is like believing that there are leprechauns. It's a nice, cute, quaint thing to say and to talk about, and a quaint way of looking at the world. But we all know that when all is said and done, the only thing that exists are the synapses of your brain firing. And when those synapses in your brain fire in a particular pattern, we call it a fear or a belief or whatever, but we all know that they really don't exist. It's just brain states is the only real reality. Well, that's probably the most popular view out there today in the secular world, because what else are you going to do except reduce us to organic robots, just like animals might in fact be, reduce us to organic robots and deny any reality beyond that. I find it very difficult to make sense out of the Bible if that were the biblical view. It seems to me that the biblical view is that a mind really does exist apart from, other than, and independent of, in some significant way, from our physical organism and the organ of our brain. Now, we do, of course, know that there's some important correlation between the brain and the mind. I think it'd be difficult to deny that there is a correlation. It's like the brain really is a tool that God has given us for my mind to use. And if the tool is somehow broken, the mind can't really use it, at least not effectively or not what we consider to be normally. So there may very well be a correlation, but a correlation doesn't justify reducing the mind to the brain. That's fallacious. And all of our common sense tells us that. I mean, all you have to do is read these books that say believing that you have a belief is like believing that leprechauns exist, and you go, okay, that's a little too far for me. I think I have beliefs when I have beliefs. And I think I know what I'm talking about. Did I even answer your question, Tobias? Through Sam? What did he say? He's typing. Okay. So let's see. Where were we?
Yeah, earlier you were talking about about our relationship to God. Yeah, I'm not. What I'm wondering is, how does what you were saying fit into when you were doing why Jesus would not be a Christian on talking about our relationship to God?
I'm missing some pieces here. What was I saying in that series that you're?
It's a while ago. So my memory might be a little hazy on this, but yeah, I think what you were saying is taking issue with a traditional view on our relationship to God.
I'm drawing a blank on when I ever talked in that series on our relationship with God.
Not is the main series, but is part of why Jesus would not be a Christian. One of 25 points.
Okay.
Oh! It was the traditional Christian's creed.
Uh huh.
Does it have to do with what it means for God to be a person?
No.
I'm sorry. We would need to go revisit the creed and point to what it was. I'm getting old.
Oh.
What I said. I'm not responsible for what I said yesterday.
Oh. Okay. Yeah. Or maybe it's because I have the notes preserved on my email.
I'm sorry. I can't reconstruct what I said enough to be able to respond. Maybe if you can give me more hints later, I can reconstruct it.
All right.
I'm lost.
So he has a follow-up, and it's, so the difference between the personage of a human and the personage of God is he doesn't need the physical tools?
Yes. Well, I don't think that's the only difference, but that is a significant difference because, interestingly, and again, we'll explore this when we look at Plato and Aristotle, what crept into Christianity was the Platonic and Aristotelian idea that it actually, especially the Platonic idea, that it makes sense that we could be a disembodied mind, or to use this language, a disembodied person somehow makes sense. But interestingly, the Bible never imagines that. Never even begins to think in those terms. My being is always an embodied existence. So I don't die and my disembodied or my quasi-body mind, you know, floats into the ether and exists with God in the ether somewhere. When I die, I'm dead, and God will raise me again to newness of life, where I will receive a new body. And the chapter 15 of 1 Corinthians makes this big, extensive argument about. There's a fleshly body and a spiritual body, I think is the language he uses. That he makes a distinction between what he calls a fleshly body, which is this body, and then a spiritual body. Now, I think we can be misled by that because we think Plato there and think, well, a spiritual body is a body that's not really a body. A spiritual body is just your soul. And think Casper the Friendly Ghost. I mean, that when I was growing up in Sunday school, I had no other concept of the soul other than Casper the Friendly Ghost style, that it's every bit of body except you can stick your hand through it and see through it. I mean, but otherwise it's a body. That's not what the Bible is thinking. That my individual personhood is a concept that the author of my being, the creator, has had in mind from before the foundation of the earth. I mean, that he invented me, he thought of me, he created me as the author of my being. And then when it came time to actualize me into existence, he gave me a body so that I could so that the concept of me as a person would have a way of expressing itself in action. Well, that's always going to be true. I'm never just a concept, at least not when I have actual existence. My actual existence will also always be expressed through a body. But the body that I'm to receive has a lot more bells and whistles than this one. I mean, it's going to be an upgrade, a significant upgrade from this one. Okay, shall I move on to the next column? So the other issue that we see explored by the pre-Socratics is ultimate reality one or many? And we've kind of talked about this a little bit, so I'll go quickly. Some of them see the plurality as ultimate. There are different beings in reality and always have been different beings in reality. Others see reality as the unity is what's ultimate. There's just one thing. So they emphasize unity versus plurality. Heraclitus, interestingly, what is ultimate reality? It's plurality within unity and unity within plurality. And I think that's what I meant to say under the biblical worldview. What is transcendent ultimate transcendent reality? It's unity, but I think what I really mean to say there is plurality within unity and unity within plurality, that same flux, that same changing nature of personhood, and the same with, but created reality is just plain plurality, pure and simple. He made a lot of different things. And I did comment on one, a popular argument for the Trinity that you see made by Christians today is that the one in the many problem can only be solved by the triune nature of God, because you have plurality within unity and unity within plurality in God. Therefore, you can explain plurality in the world. But that argument has never made any sense to me, because all you have to do to explain plurality in the world is you have a creator who makes a lot of different stuff. Problem solved. I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me that I don't even see what the problem is to start with that you need some kind of sophisticated answer to. And the unity that we intuitively sense that exists in reality, what unifies all the different things that exist in the world? The single purpose of God. However complex that purpose might be, however complex the narrative that God is creating might be, when all is said and done, it is one narrative. It is one story. So what the pre-Socratics were obviously sensing intuitively is there's some kind of unity of purpose here, unity of design here. There's a coherence to this that needs to be explained. And I think that is a great argument for the existence of God. Because how do you explain that sense that we have that there's some kind of unity of purpose in this reality that we're confronting? Well, if you have one mind behind it all, there's your explanation for the unity of purpose. So I think that's true. I think that's a valid argument. But the plurality is not a problem. It's the unity that is problematic. If anything is problematic, the plurality is not a problem. We all know that different things are different things, and there's a lot of them. Okay. Then the last column there, what's the basis for true knowledge? That's a very important issue. And what we're seeing here with the pre-Socratics is a shift in the history of ideas. Virtually all of the pre-Socratics are saying that it's reason that brings knowledge. Sense experience is only an appearance. It can be illusory. It can be deceptive. It can lead you astray. You should not rely upon sense experience. You should rely instead upon reason. And as we come out of polytheism and into this era of the pre-Socratics, there's a move that they're making that's a very, very important move in the history of ideas, an implicit trust in human reason. It's a huge step. Now, the pre-Socratics, I won't get into all the different nuances. There might be different nuances to some of their views. But how does that compare with what I think is the biblical worldview? The biblical worldview, I would argue, has a what philosophers call how you know is epistemology. That's your theory of knowledge. And I would argue that the biblical worldview just assumes what I would call a common sense epistemology. That nothing out of the ordinary, nothing unusual do they think about the way you know. That basically, if you were to ask the biblical authors, how do you know? They would say, you know the way we all know that we know. That's how we know. I mean, we know how to know. So why are you asking the question? We know how to know. But it's only in the context of the history of ideas that we have to clarify then what exactly that is. And I would argue that from the common sense epistemology that you find in the biblical worldview is that knowledge comes from sound reasoning based on empirical data gathered from sense experience. You need both. You use both. You employ both. One without the other is going to lead you astray. So the pre-Socratics are right to talk about how sense experience is not exactly infallible. And the kind of thing they have in mind, you know, is that, you know, you take a glass of water and stick a stick in it, and you look at it and the stick is bent. And you pull it out and it gets unbent, and it bends again, unbent, bends again, gets unbent. That if you're just relying upon your sense experience, you go unbent, bent, unbent, bent, unbent, bent. But what we do instead is, whoa, far out. That straight stick looks bent. We know it's straight. We know that it didn't get bent. That's an optical illusion. My sense experience is giving me the appearance of something that isn't just ain't so, just not that way. Well, so we learn to use our reasoning to adjust, correct, accommodate for what's happening in my sense experience. I don't just take my sense experience at face value. You see someone in the fog, you know, coming over the hill. It looks like my friend, but I'm not sure. When they get closer, it becomes obvious that it's not my friend. Well, did it used to be my friend and now it's not my friend? Well, everybody's my friend. Did it used to be that guy and now it's somebody else? No, it's that I recognize that my sense experience doesn't speak straight all the time. So I have to always be ready to reason about the sense data, reason about my sense experience, and make a judgment using that as the basis, but using other factors to come to my conclusion about what's true and what's real. That's common sense epistemology. Just half a second. Where reason can go wrong, and we'll see this over and over again in the history of philosophy from now on, because the tendency for philosophy from the pre-Socratics all the way to modern times, to the Enlightenment, to the so-called Enlightenment, the direction that philosophy is going to go is reason is the way to know. And what's going to happen is if you think that reason is the way to go, your argument about what's true in reality is you sit down in a chair and you think, I'm a reasonable person. How would I make the world? And you decide how you would make the world and then go, therefore, because that's reasonable, that's the way the world is. And so you go out and declare to the world how the world is based on what would be reasonable to you. Well, what common sense tells you is you can't reason out ahead of time how the world is. If you want to know how the world is, you have to go see. You have to go look. And the fallacy of rationalism, of kind of radical rationalism, the fallacy is that there's one and only one way for reality to be rational. And that's the way I figured out. Well, actually, there's probably 50 ways to be rational. And you're not going to know which way, which rational way reality is until you go look and see. And that's why your reasoning always has to be based on empirical data, sense experience, information that you've gathered by going and looking.
I don't know if this class is going to go as far as this question in terms of history, but now since we're sitting in the so-called postmodern age, and the postmoderns have rejected modernism, which I think Descartes might be a good modern, and both reason and empiricism or sensory experience are not, you know, used as a coalition in the postmodern, but in fact just simply the individual saying what is real, if I am understanding postmodernism.
Within postmodernism?
Yeah. If whatever I say.
Most postmodernists would say our culture tells us what's real, not the individual.
Okay. Are you going to be going into postmodernism?
Well, if we get
all
that far, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
How would you say that the transition to from polytheism to the worldview of a pre-Socratics is different, or is it more or less the same as the transition from the medieval era to the Enlightenment?
I think they're equally radical. Yeah, I think you have a radical shift going to the pre-Socratics from polytheism, and it was a very radical shift going from the Middle Ages to modern philosophy. And hopefully we'll have a chance to explore that. But yeah, it was a revolution in the history of ideas, and I think with the pre-Socratics, we're dealing with a revolution in the history of ideas.
More or less the same type of shift?
Well, they're in a different direction, and I mean, it depends what you mean by the same type of shift. I'm talking about they're the same with respect to the degree of significance and the degree of impact it had, to what extent it gave you different lenses to look at the world through. How different are those lenses? I would say they are equally different here as they are in the Enlightenment. Couple of other issues. This is on your other sheet that you got at first on the back, the biblical worldview and the issues raised by pre-Socratic philosophy. Which is ultimate, chaos or cosmos? The biblical answer is clearly cosmos. God is a rational, purposing, ordering mind. He exists when nothing else exists and is the source of all other existence. God created a cosmos where before there was blank, sterile nothingness and no ordering principles. He did not impose order on chaos. He created out of nothing, out of blank, sterile nothingness. He created a cosmos. That's the biblical perspective. So unlike the polytheists before that saw this kind of soupy chaos that was the beginning of all things and the God Most High imposed cosmos on that chaos, God just creates it out of nothing. This is going to come up again over and over again. This whole idea of chaos versus cosmos, something versus nothing, what kind of nothing is it? We're probably not accustomed to thinking of different kinds of nothingness. We only have one word for nothing, but we should have several different words for nothing. So I will invent words. There's what I called blank, sterile nothingness. And then there's pregnant nothingness. And pregnant nothingness is the concept of nothingness that we're going to see in Aristotle. And I think you have it in the polytheists before, where nothingness, there may not be anything there, but the possibility exists for there to be something there. And if you conceive of that possibility as arising out of deep down hidden principles that come into play in order to bring something into being, then there may not be anything there, but there are things at work. There are things that exist. There are forces back behind the nothingness that could be triggered to bring something into being. That's what I'm calling pregnant nothingness. That is, there's the there's always the potentiality of something being triggered into existence. I think the perspective in the Bible is not that God came upon a vast sea of pregnant nothingness and called forth something out of the nothingness. No, he was confronted with a blank, sterile nothingness. There was nothing there and not even the possibility of being anything there. And yet he spoke into existence the world that is. That's how I would read Genesis 1 when he says the world was, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. How's it go? Anyway, the world was tohu vabohu, and they usually translate that without form and void. But I think what it's trying to say is, there weren't nothing there, and there weren't no principles, ordering principles or structures in place to bring about anything there. There wasn't anything there, and there was no framework for anything to exist in. You not only had nothingness, but you didn't even have physics. You didn't have chemistry. You didn't have even anything that could be the ordering principles that would define an existing thing. All that is created by God. I mean, I think visually what we tend to think of is God came across a vast sea of empty space. But the minute you think of it as empty space, you've got physics at play, you've got geometry at play, you've got all kinds of things that already exist. Well, God wasn't working with those things that already existed. He came across blank, sterile nothingness and yet created something. So you have to make sure you got the right nothing when you conceive of God creating out of nothing. We already talked about change or permanence in the next one. Yeah, I guess we talked about all that. So look at the shift from polytheism to pre-Socratic philosophy, and then we'll be done here. In polytheism, we have complex, fickle, unpredictable gods. They're personal gods, but they're unpredictable and kind of quixotic and infantile in their responses and their attitudes, and therefore it makes for a very tenuous kind of order. The pre-Socratics, they still have gods in a way. The atoms, air, water, the indeterminate, fire, logos, all these things that they posit are the ultimate existing thing, are playing the role of gods in their worldview, more or less. But notice that they are simpler, law-like, and predictable. Water is something that you could come to understand and predict the outcome of. Air, the same thing. Fire, less predictable, but it's a phenomenon that you can grasp. Nothing is complex as a person with the purposes and will and designs and schemings of a person, which is what the polytheists think are the ultimate forces that shape their lives. So this is a step toward the possibility of science now. Because if you think that the determining factors that are shaping reality run according to ordered law-like principles, then what if you came to know and understand those principles? Then you could know how the universe is going to go, what the universe is and how it's going to operate. Well, that makes possible the exploration of the science of nature for the first time, really. I think it's only a step closer to science. Because with the pre-Socratics, if you'll notice, and this is what Socrates was complaining about, Anaxagoras, I believe it was it, whoever he was, I think it was Anaxagoras. It might have been Empedocles, but he was complaining that, you know, he proposed that nous had to be used to explain the beginning of Anaxagoras, the beginning of everything, and Socrates gets all excited because that's beginning to make sense to him. Because a nous would explain why you're positing cosmos rather than chaos. Otherwise, all the other pre-Socratics are just saying, in my judgment, the world is more cosmic than it is chaotic. Well, are you right? Well, I think so. Well, you could start science from there, but notice the shaky foundation that that is. It's really not until you get to Christianity that science really has a basis upon which it can get started. Because not only are you believing that reality is cosmic rather than chaotic, you do believe that, but you believe that for a very definite reason. Because there's a mind behind it that has created a cosmos. So I know it's a cosmos. I can be confident that it's a cosmos. Let me go look and see what the nature of the cosmic order is. And that's when science really gets off the ground. So the only other thing here that we haven't talked about at the very bottom of that column, in polytheism, the gods are above nature, and that's why Aristotle labels the polytheists before the pre-Socratics theology. They're god freaks. They believe that gods are what control reality. And when the pre-Socratics he labels as I don't know how to pronounce Latin. Physici, I guess. Physici, nature freaks. They're believers in nature, not believers in God. And what he means by that is, what are the elements that determine and shape reality? Are they something above and beyond nature, or are they something actually within nature? And the pre-Socratics are putting them within nature. So gods, though they may be, they're gods inside reality, not gods outside of reality. Now, we've already talked about the outside of reality of the polytheist is still not like the outside of reality of the biblical worldview. Their gods are not ultimately transcendent. They just live upstairs. So in a sense, they're in reality. But they're not in reality in the same way that that the pre-Socratics have their gods inside reality, because for the pre-Socratics, the gods are, that they are in effect pantheists, what we would typically call pantheists, that it's the, they are the forces at work in us, through us, around us, in the trees, in the mountains, in the asphalt. They're in everything. But they're the essential, foundational, underlying principles in everything. Okay, I'm going to be done with the pre-Socratics, so you have 2 minutes to ask any question you have about them. Okay, next week we'll go on to the Sophists and then talk about Socrates.
Tobias has one question. Is the chaos order debate that goes on, does that have anything to do with a discussion about God's sovereignty, or are those different issues?
Well, I don't know if it ever gets framed in exactly that way, but certainly anyone who rejects divine determinism and a view of God's sovereignty where literally every iota of everything happens is ultimately controlled and caused by God. If you reject that view, then you have to explain, well, where does this other stuff come from? And oftentimes, I mean, I think there are a lot of Christians today who believe in chance, for example, or when you ask them, what is free will? When I make a free will choice, what's causing the free will choice? They would basically kind of stumble, and if they stumble off onto anything at all, it would be, well, my will causes it. I mean, it's sort of like it's self-causing, it's self-generating. So we have to come up with some basis for the cause of things that God does not cause, and it ends up being a kind of chaos that somehow is able to give rise to something.